This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Like, is ChatGPT going to pardon Trump? I don't know. I didn't ask it yet.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow, and this is our weekly roundup, where we invite a rotating panel of experts to discuss the truth you need to know behind the most important stories of the week and how they're shaping the political landscape. And on today's incredible panel, returning to the roundup is Politicology fan favorite, sitting here in studio with me, Lene Erickson. Lene is the Senior Vice President for the Social Policy and Politics Program at Third Way. She also served on President Obama's Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. Lene, as always, it's great to see you. Welcome back.
So good to see you. And what the audience can't see is that Ron and I are twinning right now.
We are definitely twinning. That is a long story. And also sitting here with us at the table and making her Politicology debut is Amy Walter. Amy is the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter. She provides weekly political analysis for the PBS NewsHour Politics Monday segment. She's also a regular Sunday panelist on Meet the Press and CNN's Inside Politics. She previously hosted the weekly nationally syndicated program Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRX, and is the former political director of ABC News, but most importantly, she's a member of the Bad News Babes, the press team in the congressional women's softball game. Amy. Yes,
I'm glad. Thank you. I'm glad you brought that up. The game is coming up July 12th. Everyone, you can buy your tickets, see
is it
women
televised?
Members. No.
Really?
I think the men's game is, but you know what? That's for another day. But ours is so fun. Women members of Congress, Dem and Republicans, only bipartisan sporting event, versus the women members of the press. We had a tough game last year, so we're coming back for revenge.
Well, way to represent.
Thank
Welcome
you.
To Politicology.
Thank you.
It's
happy to be here.
And on such a slow news week, I wish we really had to scrape the barrel to figure out what we're going to talk about this week. Up first, we'll discuss the reactions to Donald Trump's indictment on federal charges for his mishandling of classified documents and obstructing the government's efforts to collect those documents. Then we're going to look at the politics of privacy, including controversy over a federal program that allows the government to engage in surveillance, and a new report about the intelligence community buying private data about Americans and how distrust in government, legitimate and manufactured, is shaping our politics. And finally, for our Politicology Plus subscribers, we're going to discuss the Supreme Court's decision rejecting racially gerrymandered voting maps in Alabama that diluted Black voters' power. To get ad-free access to the show, plus many more special episodes on a private podcast feed, head on over to politicology.com/plus or click the link at the top of today's show notes, and we'll dig in right after this.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
A reading from the Book of Lamentations. Friend, reports state that I could receive a maximum sentence of 400 years in prison, despite being a totally and completely innocent man. I honestly cannot believe I just typed those words to you. It sounds like something Stalin or Mao did to eliminate their opposition, but instead, it's happening here in America. Communism has finally come to our shores. We are no longer living in the country of Washington and Lincoln. For the first time in American history, the federal government has used its prosecutorial powers to charge the leading opponent of the current regime. While today is certainly a grim and dark day, do not lose faith. As I said once before, with a dark cloud over our beloved country, I have no doubt, nevertheless, that we will make America, say it with me, great again. Please make a contribution to Peacefully Stand With Me and save the greatest country in history for a 1,500% impact. That's the fundraising email Trump's team sent out on Tuesday afternoon. while he was being arraigned on federal charges over his mishandling of classified documents after he left the White House and his obstruction of the government's efforts to reclaim their documents. After Trump's arraignment in Florida, he flew to New Jersey and held a fundraiser at his Bedminster golf course. And in the speech, he misrepresented the Presidential Records Act. He also called the indictment, quote, the most evil and heinous abuse of power in the history of the country. He said that, quote, a corrupt sitting president had his top political opponent arrested on fake and fabricated charges, of which he and numerous other presidents would be guilty right in the middle of a presidential election in which he is losing very badly. Lots of mistakes in there. It currently looks like 2024 rematch of Trump and Biden is a toss-up, and the facts of the case point to Trump sitting all alone in his obstruction. I want to talk about the messaging today and the politics and the responses, because we just walked through all of the legal stuff with George Conway earlier this week. So, Amy, I'd love to start with you just at a very high level. What impact do you think this messaging is going to have first on the base and the primary? We'll turn to the general politics in a minute, but let's talk about the primary field first and how the messaging is going to play.
So I think what we're starting to see is there's the predictable rally around Donald Trump, because if you ask the question this way, do you think that Trump is being unfairly prosecuted, persecuted, attacked? Republican voters will say, absolutely. Do you think a lot of these charges are trumped up, made up, and are they similar? Is he being charged with things that Hillary Clinton did not? Absolutely. Do you think he'd be a good candidate for reelection? Right? Mm. Now, they say they still would like to vote for him. He is still winning among Republican primary voters. But what I'm starting to pick up in a lot of the reporting that's out there, listening to people who've been in Iowa, reading other reports from states like Georgia, you can hear in voters' voices, Republican voters, even the most conservative, even the most supportive of Donald Trump, a sort of weariness. Mm. An exhaustion. Now, it is not to the place yet where they've said, okay, I'm breaking with him, but I don't think it's going to look like that. Mm. I think the assumption has been for a long time that there are going to be these charges, these legal impediments, if you will, that are going to pile up and pile up, and then there's going to be one straw that's just going to break it all and Trump's going to collapse. I don't think it works like that. I think that it's clear that there's some exhaustion out there. If you are his Republican opponent, one of his Republican opponents, your opportunity is to latch on to that exhaustion and say, you're right. Of course he's getting persecuted. Of course the liberal media hates him. Of course the DOJ is being politicized. But you know what? Like, this is a lot of baggage,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And nobody said that yet. But you can see them sort of gearing up to say that.
Yeah.
So this idea that there's just like one punch that's going to take him out, I don't think that is true. But I do think that you can kind of feel the wariness and now and the weariness. And for the opponents, they've got to be able to take this moment in time and make themselves a compelling alternative.
So there's been a mixed bag of responses from elected Republicans. Speaker Kevin McCarthy came to his defense. He said that it was a, quote, very dark day in America. When McCarthy was asked about Trump keeping boxes of documents in a bathroom at Mar-a-Lago, McCarthy responded that a bathroom door locks, Lene. Also, as we were discussing earlier, Kevin McCarthy clearly does not know that bathroom doors lock from the inside.
The boxes, they lock themselves.
Jim Jordan has insisted that Donald Trump declassified all of the documents he took with him. But we've seen former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson and former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, both of whom are running for the Republican nomination and hovering close to 1% in national polls, condemn Trump after the indictment. Christie called Trump's conduct awful and said that Trump's actions outlined in the indictment are vanity run amok. And Senator Mitt Romney, for his part, expressed anger with Trump. And here's what he had to say.
I'm angry. The country is going to go through tumult as a result of one thing. President Trump didn't turn over military documents when he was asked to do so. Why did he just turn the documents in? Had he done so, he certainly would not have been indicted. I'm sure his lawyers told him that. What was the purpose?
So, Lene, I'm curious about first of all, what you make of the difference between the responses among the Republican electeds, especially on the Hill, whether there's sort of cracks beginning to show in their support. I think as Amy said, it's like, we're trying to figure out where exactly the right line is here without going too far. But also at the same time, the tension between what Romney said, which is the country's going to go through tumult as a result of this, which is, you know, we can turn to the gravity of that when we get to Biden not saying anything about this, et cetera. But keeping the focus on the Republicans' response right now, how are you reading this?
You know, I think Asa Hutchinson and Mitt Romney are such lovely humans, and their impact on the current Republican Party is -0. and that's been true for a while because they broke earlier, maybe not as early as I would have liked, but they broke a long time ago. And so I don't think that they don't bring anybody else along with them, either voters or electeds. Like, you knew what Mitt Romney was going to say about this. It didn't impact his other senatorial friends. So it's kind of like when you're like, I got Murkowski, and you're like, cool, that's it. Like, she doesn't bring a whole bunch of other people along with her. I did think it was interesting that, you know, obviously Kevin McCarthy is like, has decided to kneel at the golden toilet of Trump long ago. But he also had all these dynamics this week that were playing in that made it so that he could do nothing but support Trump, because what Kevin McCarthy was dealing with in his day job was a whole bunch of crazy, the most right of his caucus, literally shutting down the floor, voting down a rule to move to their, like, save the gas stoves bill, which they all, you know, supported. But in protest of the deal he made with Biden around the debt ceiling. So he literally couldn't run the House floor for 2 weeks because these people were like, no, we don't like what you did. We don't like the fact that you didn't tank the economy and you agreed to this spending deal with Biden, and we are going to take the power back. So they didn't oust him, but they shut down business. And so he's busy over here trying to deal with his crazy people, get them in line, and then the Trump thing's happening. Like, he's already, you know, trying to soothe Matt Gaetz. Like, there was nothing else he could do. And so I think we knew what he was going to say. I do think that there were some other senators that were kind of like, in the attitude that Amy was talking about, that was like, yeah, I mean, I don't love this. Like, Joni Ernst said something like that. There were some other folks that haven't broken before that were like, it's not my favorite. And I think that that was more interesting. But also, they're walking the same line, right? Chris Christie went way beyond the line. Yeah. And also, for that reason, is going to be inconsequential, I think, unless he really takes it to him in the debate stage, which I think would be fun, but I don't know that he's even going to get there. And because Chris Christie basically said, Trump's a bad person, he only cares about himself, like, this is bad. And that's too far for these Republican voters. You got to pull it back to this, like, of course he's being persecuted, and also maybe we want to talk about something else now.
I know. And, you know, the other interesting thing about the floor, speaking about the Republicans, it puts those vulnerable House Republicans, the ones who sit in those Biden districts, everybody knows there are 18 of them, DCCC is targeting all of them, and they definitely wiped their brow after the debt ceiling, right? Like, we got a bipartisan deal, everybody signed off of it, great. Because it helped them not just, as Lene pointed out, have a default-induced economic collapse, but they were able then to show distinction with Trump. You can't call me MAGA. Right. Don't call me Trump. Trump wanted us to default. I didn't do that. But now you have Matt Gaetz and Jordan et al. Let's bring up the FBI. Let's defund the FBI. Let's do with Schiff, let's kick Schiff off of committees because of his fake Russia witch hunt, right? Every time they force those vulnerable Republicans to make a vote that defends Trump, it puts them in that awkward position as they're trying to run for re-election.
Yeah, and to Lene's point about the gas stoves thing, this was the Freedom Caucus essentially saying, "Yeah, okay, it's over, but it's not over yet, right? We're here and we're not going anywhere, and like you're gonna have to deal
Except
with
what us. Are they gonna do? This is the thing about them. They can do something like shut down the floor, but okay, now what?
Yeah.
Well, are you going to overturn? Oh, we're going to get rid of McCarthy. Yeah, right. Oh, really? With who? Who's your person?
Yeah. No, but what they are going to do is set up a government shutdown because they've now said, hey, remember those appropriations numbers we just agreed to in the deal that everybody signed off on?
We're not doing that.
Yeah. We're doing less than that. And now they're trying to get the open seat. There was a representative who had to retire. They're trying to get that open seat on the Appropriations Committee for themselves. And I'm really worried about that. That was going to be my look ahead, what people aren't paying attention to, because it's scary and it could potentially shut down the government in September. And we've seen all of these non-calamitous effects of them being able to get this deal, but they're essentially reneging on it now.
Amy, before we pivot over to Biden non-response, non-saying anything about this indictment, it's way too early to start talking about polling vis-a-vis the general election 2024. It's way too early even to really start talking about polling in the primary, except that there have been
Is it ever too early?
Here's the thing, right? Well, politicology listeners know not to pay attention to national polls pretty much ever, and that, you know, because that's not the way we elect a president. But there have been, prior to the indictment, there were just a couple of polls out, I think, in Arizona, perhaps one in Georgia, definitely one in Nevada, that were showing essentially DeSantis performing better against Biden, maybe plus up one, something like that, but all within the margin, and Trump down a few. I don't want to read these polls as being meaningful for the primary, but they're meaningful for decisions people are making
now. Well,
that's right. So can you unpack that a little
bit?
Right.
I mean, they're meaningful in that.
Yes.
Look, this is what the DeSantis team would like to do. And many of these polls that have been released were by Republican organizations that are supportive of someone not named Donald Trump being the nominee.
Public opinion strategies, for example. Yep.
So I get that. And the case they'll make to really the donor class, much more than the voting class, is, you guys, look, you've got to keep putting money behind either DeSantis or whoever the alternative is, because it's pretty clear that anybody can beat Biden except Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Now, the challenge with using that with voters and sometimes even with donors is, one, it's not like it's a big margin. It's not like DeSantis is up by 45 and Trump is losing by 30, right? It's like all within the margin. The second is, again, even with donors, yeah, so let's talk about polls for a minute. Remember the polls in 2016 that said Trump couldn't win? And remember the polls in 2020 that said Biden was going to win in a landslide? So what are you telling me? Yeah. I don't believe any of this.
Yeah.
And then as you look, you're right, the national polls don't tell us, but at the end of the day, there is not going to be a number that is going to get Republican voters and even some of the donor class to say, whew, well, thank you for giving me that poll, because now that I have that, I am convinced.
Super clear.
I am convinced that DeSantis is the person and we need to go all in.
Yeah.
And as I said, there's not going to be this magic moment where it's all going to become like, clear that we've got to go in a different direction. I think that's why, yes, the debate stage is important. I agree with Lene, who knows who's going to show up, who's not going to show up, who's going to make it, et cetera. And then the second thing is, something has to happen in Iowa.
Yeah.
Like, if Trump wins Iowa, a state that is really tailor-made for a non-kind of Trump candidate, then, okay.
It's really made for Pence.
That's what they think,
for
sure.
Yeah.
But a lot of folks want to make that breakthrough there. And then at least you have a toehold. It's not going to say that Trump's going to lose if he loses Iowa. But if he wins Iowa, I don't know how you. Yeah.
Well, especially because, and I think we've talked about this before, the way that Republicans use their nomination is that if you win the state, you get all of the delegates from
that
state. It's a winner-take-all system. Whereas, you know, Democrats, it's proportional. Mm-hmm. So if you recall the debacle in Iowa last time Democrats had it.
Pete Buttigieg remembers.
Right. Pete Buttigieg technically won, I think, but real close to Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. A week later, he won.
Right. But they've got they got almost exactly the same number of delegates out of that because it's proportional. Whereas, you know, the way Trump won last time was he started rolling in. And if you take the state, even if somebody else gets 29% and you get 30, they get nothing. And that's really hard to compete with, especially because everyone and their mother is now running for the Republican nomination. Yeah. I heard this morning that the Miami mayor threw his hat in the ring. Like,
didn't know who that guy was.
Yeah. Don't think he's going to be the next president.
But he's not, but he's good. He's polished and great.
I'm into it. Yeah. Let's put them on the debate stage. But they're going to have what we had last time, which is maybe we have to have two nights of debates because we have 40 people and we can't fit them all on stage. So that means all you have to get is about a third and then you win everything. And it's really hard for me to see how Donald Trump doesn't come through with, you know, the plurality in a lot of these states. Obviously, Iowa's the key. But even there, you know, there's got to be a third of Republican voters that are with him, I would think.
Yeah, I imagine that to be true. So for his part, President Biden and his top aides have been completely silent on Trump's indictment. And candidly, I'm really happy to see that.
Yep.
I think it is exactly the right thing for him to do. At the start of his presidency, Biden said he would not discuss DOJ investigations, particularly those about Trump. And so far, the White House, his campaign, and the DNC have all been quiet about the investigations into Trump. And I have to say, Lene, that's like remarkably disciplined for the Democratic
that's
Party.
That's true. We're not good at discipline.
Like remarkably disciplined. Politico is reporting that they are deeply wary of any perception that Biden's tried to influence the investigations. And I think they are right to be deeply wary of that. Some of Biden's allies are concerned that Biden could be missing a chance to underscore the seriousness of the moment and deliver a major blow to the Trump campaign. So I'd love for you to walk through what the intra-party politics look like over this right now and whether do you think that discipline's going to hold? Or if everyone will recognize that piling on Trump right now, especially from partisan voices, is only going to fuel not just the fundraising, but the distrust in government, which we're going to talk about in the next segment, and the you know the idea that there's a lot of hypocrisy going on and the country's in a really dangerous way.
You know, I think that most Democrats realize that this is a really scary moment in that we do have this person running for president as the front runner. And, you know, the current president is also the front runner. And so there are dynamics here that are really, really sensitive. And yet we had this indictment move forward because the behavior was so incomprehensible. And I think, you know, honestly, if the Biden folks could like not ever have to deal with this, they'd probably be happy because I think they're very worried about the message it sends to have the Biden administration going after Trump. And so they're making it really clear that this is not the Biden administration. This is an independent prosecutor. And you know, I think that's smart. I hope it holds. But because I think, you know, there's this phrase that you use in law school. It's called res ipsa loquitur, which means the thing speaks for itself. That's where we're at, right? Like, we don't need somebody to be like, oh, and also, did you read the 67th? You know, charge in here, like the thing speaks for itself. Yeah. And if we've got this Trump judge like ruling against him, that's a much better spokesperson than like AOC or Biden or whoever else the Democratic Party. So I think, you know, I think they're right to be quiet and I hope it holds.
Yeah. So what happens though when the investigation into Biden's handling of classified documents, right? And they say, oh, actually, his are fine. It was fine. It was, he did it accidentally, and the Corvette, we don't know how they got there. And
they gave him right back.
No
right.
obstruction, which no seems to be like the real linchpin of this prosecution. So.
That, and then you have to do the whole, okay, double standard, and we go back through it all
And Americans
again.
Aren't lawyers.
No.
Like voters aren't expected, you can't be expected to know the law at this level of intricacy.
I don't think they are, but they also realize there's a difference between like packing some stuff up and then being like, I wasn't supposed to have this here, it's back, versus the step-by-step-by-step-by-step collusion of the Trump folks. Right. So I think that's kind of common sense, but it's scary, and that's why they're walking
very
gingerly.
So who makes that case?
Yeah.
that there's a difference between
because low
Biden
information
and,
voters are going to sit back, and when it comes time to vote, like a couple months beforehand,
they all do it,
but they're going to look back and see.
No. They say all, but both sides
sure,
do it, right?
That's what I mean.
That's right.
Hillary had those emails,
they're all corrupt. Biden, how did we end up in a place where we got these two?
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's better when we keep pairing Biden with Pence. We're like, there's the Biden-Pence version of I accidentally had some documents.
Smart.
And then there's the Trump version. And I think we should never say the word Hillary in our whole lives.
Yeah.
Like, I still have the swag. I'm here for it. I'm with her. But like, it going back, I mean, I heard yesterday, like, yeah, but what about those, 33,000 deleted emails? And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going back in time to a place I don't ever want to be again. Like, we do not need to litigate the Clinton stuff. People already think that Hillary and Bill did not follow rules in general and did not think that rules applied to them. I don't need to fight
that. And got away with it.
Like,
they think they got away with it.
Yeah. Let's leave bygones be bygones in the Clinton folks. And I think it's much more easy to defend Biden because people don't actually think that he doesn't think rules apply to him. They think he's kind of messy and like maybe wasn't super careful, but I don't think they have the same like insidiousness that they feel towards the Clintons. And that applies to both Clintons, that they were actively using government to advance their own cause.
Yeah, although the colloquially called investigations committee is really working on that with the Hunter Biden stuff. So watch this space.
The Hunter Biden stuff is not helpful.
Yeah,
just
yeah. So one of the political realities here, and it's not an argument against the indictment, but the reality is this is going to lead to increased polarization. Like, full stop, hands down. We're already seeing this from Republicans that they believe the indictment's politically motivated, and a huge portion of the Republican electorate still believes 2020 was stolen from Trump. And this is almost definitely going to lead to calls that 2024 was stolen if he gets the general election and loses. So there's this chance that Donald Trump could win in 2024 and be both the president-elect and a defendant in one or more criminal cases. He could be in jail by then. We have no idea. The best case scenario here, like there are several like decent good cases scenario here for the rule of law. This is a good day for the rule of law, but there are also really some terrifying, and I don't use that word lightly, terrifying bad cases here, bad outcomes, which would lead to not just a constitutional crisis, but would actually break us, I think.
How we always seem to be skirting on these. Like, just think about, I go back and look at even 2020, even before we got into the election was stolen and January 6th, 42,000 votes go the other way in Arizona, Georgia, Wisconsin, and we are at 270.
Yep.
And we have the President of the United States being picked by Congress. What?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, America does not know how the whole tied electoral college works.
No.
Maybe you learned it in fifth grade. Probably don't remember it. But, and it's not the, it's like, each delegation gets one vote.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So Alaska gets as many votes as California?
Correct.
What?
And that's not even a thing. Like, are people going around being like, right now the House delegations are split between this and this? Like, that's the thing I had to look up, and I work here. Like, it's not a well-known fact.
Right. So we get really, really close. We're like, whew, okay, well, this year, okay, we didn't have that. But next year, so it is, it's almost like every year we look at, okay, well, what is going to be the potential thing that breaks us or the constitutional crisis? And you're exactly right. Yeah. This idea of a candidate for president who is under indictment.
Right. That's first thing.
Start.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then candidate for president who is currently a defendant. We have a case going on while he's running and then potentially
and then he could win.
And like, then could win. And then does he pardon? I mean, it's all
a gigantic explosion of question marks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and I think it's interesting, too. Even in 2022, we had that by the skin of our teeth moment, because we had the election deniers who were running for the offices that would count the votes.
Yeah.
And we got through that one and we're like, phew. And now we're like, okay, what's the next phew moment here? And I have no idea how this one is going to play out. But, I mean, if Trump
is in office, he's going to pardon himself, which is a whole thing. They're certainly going to make it, I think you and George were talking about this, a litmus test mm-hmm. for all the other candidates to say they'd pardon him. You know, Vivek Ramaswamy's like way up front on that one, mm-hmm. but now he's making everybody else do it. And it's going to be their equivalent of our version of my nightmare when they asked, you know, do you support open borders? And all mm-hmm. of the candidates on stage raised their hand. And I just got under my bed in the fetal position. But that's the dynamic. Once you're on the debate stage, you're not going to be like, no, I'm not going to pardon him. Yeah. Of course I support open borders. Of course I support pardoning Donald Trump. And so, what that means any Republican win is a Donald Trump pardon. I don't see how we don't at least get to there.
Here's a good question, actually, just like lightning question. We look back on the Ford Nixon pardon as like a really proud moment of American history.
But it sure wasn't at that time.
So how do you think history might judge a pardon in this case?
Oh, Lord. Are we going to have a history?
assuming we make it through.
Right, like, first of all, we got to make it through AI taking over and destroying humanity. So I don't know how much time we have left, actually. We may not even get, 50 years from now.
Like, is ChatGPT going to pardon Trump?
I don't know. I didn't ask it yet. That's actually what's going to happen. Exactly. That's exactly right. Thank you for that, Lynnae.
The reason I opened with that email that Trump sent is because it was just right on cue. And also several months ago when we were talking about this, I said, this is one of the best, politically one of the best things that could happen to him. Very, very bad day for Donald Trump, the person, but for the campaign, enormous boon, especially for fundraising.
Didn't they say they raised $2.5 million?
I'm sure they did.
Something like that.
Yeah. And so this is any good political marketer will tell you, if you don't have a good boogeyman, you're not going anywhere. And this is like the best boogeyman you could possibly have. There's one other thing I wanted to cover here. That's the Koch Networks advertising against Trump in the primary. They gave CNBC an exclusive look at a round of digital ads. I know we're all shrugging. Targeting primary voters in Iowa, South Carolina, New Hampshire, and Nevada. They're focused on getting Republican primary voters to vote for anyone but Trump. They think a 2020 rematch will lead to a second Biden term. Here's a clip of one of those ads titled, "No Thanks."
Trump did a lot of good things as president, but this time, Trump can't win. Swing voters say no. 60% of Americans don't want him. In 2024, Biden will beat Trump. We need new leadership.
The always insightful Tim Miller wrote a piece for The Bulwark where he argued that these ads are, quote, atrocious, and he's totally right, that they won't be effective for a couple of reasons. Part of its style, they feel, like people are being lectured by the old guard DC elites that they already don't like. There's the unelectability argument, which Amy walked through earlier, which is completely ineffective. There's a problem with the audience here. I don't understand why they would leak these ads to CNBC if they're targeting primary voters. Like it's the moderate wing of the moderate wing of the party. It makes zero sense. But what do you make of this push from Koch, the network? Typically I have to say, whatever you think about their politics, the Koch octopus is usually pretty effective at what it decides to do. This doesn't make any sense to me, Amy.
It is almost word for word what you could distill from focus groups, Republican focus groups from last fall and earlier this year, and they would say exactly that. Trump's great. He was a great president. I don't know. I don't think he can win, or maybe would be nice to have somebody new, fresh face, right?
Yeah.
Which is lovely. But literally transcribing a focus group into an ad, you've got to go a little bit deeper than that, right? Yeah. And get to the heart of what it is. What is this exhaustion about? And again, it's not simply that, oh my gosh, Biden's going to win. It's that this guy is not, this guy's going to, could potentially go to jail, right? Like, mm-hmm. let's be really clear. Yeah, you can like what he did as president, but this is some serious stuff, right? If you really, really want to go at it. And if you believe what a lot of Republican pollsters believe, or and folks who've been studying the Republican electorate believe, that there is basically a 35% core Trump vote that nothing you say can move them. That is still a significant portion of the electorate that you can move off of him, right? And do you move it off of him by being, I mean, this is the internal debate right now, the Chris Christie, right?
Yeah.
How do you get underneath that? And so Lene will appreciate, this is my new theory or maybe analogy. As somebody who comes from a place that has a lot of snow,
I do.
I think you've shoveled probably before.
Shoveled a lot of snow.
Okay. So, you know, when you're shoveling, say, the driveway, and you didn't realize that underneath it had already gotten an ice layer, right? And you're
it's the worst.
Oh, it's the worst. And so you have two choices. One is you just kind of like chip, 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 try to get little chunks off, or you find that seam. There's that one seam you can get, and then the whole thing comes out in one big chunk. And so it feels like what Republicans are doing right now is like just chipping around, as opposed to there's got to be a seam there somewhere to go underneath it and go, this is the thing. And nobody's found that seam, because it's not, as I said, there's not one issue you're just going to say, oh, okay, if we convince enough Republicans it's X, they're going to come with me.
As a northern Minnesotan, I think that is absolutely physically accurate the snow.
Thank you.
But, you know, it also, I think that seam is not electability.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's right.
Because they forget. Like, this is an ad that could be, if the names were different, potentially very effective with Democratic primary voters. Because when you ask Democratic primary voters, you know, do you want somebody who completely agrees with you and the issues, or somebody who can win? We vote like pundits. Mm. And this is why we got Joe Biden. Mm. Because we're like, you know what? You don't like light my hair on fire, but I think you might be our best bet. Because we're always thinking, okay, who is the swing voter that this person needs to appeal to? And who would appeal to that person? And, you know, it's why folks like Elizabeth Warren and even Kamala really struggled, because not because people didn't like them, but because people thought swing voters wouldn't like them. Well, Republicans do not think that way. Yeah. They consistently say, I want the person that I want. And then they believe in their hearts that then that person can win. And they've been right in a lot of instances when the punditry has been wrong. So I just think it's the wrong argument to make to them. Mm-hmm. And in the weariness is more of the argument to make. Yeah. Like, listen, I didn't think that the Republican base could ever get tired. Like, you know, but we saw the Democratic base get tired. Yeah. Like, we're all
tired.
Do we want the chaos?
Yeah. And so maybe that's the
fatigue.
Thing. The chaos and the fatigue and the not knowing and the, like, there was some good stuff, but man, it comes with so much of the baggage. Is that it?
Yeah.
Obviously, the DeSantis team thinks, no, it's all about cultural issues.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Show him as out of touch on CRT and wokeness. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that's it either.
No.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm tired of talking about this.
Yeah.
Could be it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I know I'm tired of talking about this.
All right.
But they might be too.
Yeah. Right.
That's a good segue. So let's talk about privacy, which is not just a topic that I've been thinking about a lot over the last 6 months or so, but also as it relates to distrust in government and just distrust in institutions writ large, which is such a huge feature of the politics we were just discussing in the primary. So specifically, there were a couple of privacy stories that caught my attention this week. On Tuesday, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing about reauthorizing surveillance powers. This is known as Section 702. Section 702 permits warrantless surveillance against foreign threats. This is a 9/11 era provision, and it's set to expire at the end of the year unless Congress renews it. And senators across the aisle warned Biden administration officials that they're not going to renew the surveillance authorities without substantial changes, because when the intelligence community surveils foreign threats, they also collect communications with Americans. And that data goes into a database that law enforcement can search using phone numbers, email addresses, lots of other identifiers. All of that can happen without a warrant. There are supposed to be restrictions on it. The FBI can search the database when they have evidence of crimes or for foreign intelligence purposes, but A recently unsealed court document found that the FBI had misused the database more than 278,000 times between 2020 and early 2021. They searched for thousands of donors to a congressional candidate, and they searched for people protesting after the murder of George Floyd. Senator John Ossoff of Georgia grilled FBI officials, among his colleagues, over their use of the database for domestic law enforcement, and we've got a clip of that exchange.
It's the case, is it not, that the FBI can query this database for U.S. person communications simply seeking evidence of a crime? It does not have to be a national security investigation, correct?
It is correct, Senator, thank you for the question, that the FBI can search using a U.S. person identifier for either foreign intelligence or evidence of a crime, but there must be a reasonable basis to believe that there is information in the Section 702 data that would be responsive to such a query.
Yeah, why should there not be a warrant requirement for these searches, which are known as crime-only searches, whereby FBI agents are seeking the communications of Americans, either considering opening a criminal investigation or in the midst of a predicated criminal investigation? So why should there not be a warrant requirement for such a U.S. person query?
So stepping back for a moment, if I may, just to provide—
Just for a moment.
Very quickly, Section 702 is a foreign intelligence tool. It's yes. Not a law enforcement
right.
tool.
So why is it used for domestic law enforcement purposes?
It has been used exceedingly rarely where a query using a U.S. person identifier would have identified information that did not have a foreign intelligence purpose. So outside of the national security realm, not involving a terrorism or espionage or cyber charge or investigation.
Yeah, so it can be used for this purpose, and it has been used for this purpose.
2022, it was 16 different times. 14 of those times where it was used for evidence of a crime only were where the U.S. government had an affirmative discovery obligation to search.
Well, we'll get into those numbers in a second, but it begs the question, if it's so rare as you state, why not go get a warrant?
So this hearing, I've chosen the John Ossoff clip, by the way, because lots of the other Republican questioners were really bombastic, but were making essentially the same point. And Ossoff was essentially asking the same pointed questions in a more polite way. But the point is to illustrate it's not just Republicans and Democrats too here. And this hearing came after Wired reported that the U.S. government has been secretly amassing a large amount of sensitive and intimate information on its own citizens. And this was coming from an official report written more than a year ago by senior advisors for Avril Haines, the director of national intelligence, but was just declassified and released last Friday. And this report makes it clear that intelligence agencies are buying information about Americans that they would not be able to directly collect legally because of the Fourth Amendment. And this is because the government's interpretation of quote unquote publicly available information includes information that is available for sale. So to put this in real terms, the intelligence community believes that it can persistently track the phones of millions of Americans as long as they buy that information. If they were to go to a service provider and demand access to the location data, they'd need a warrant because it falls under the Fourth Amendment definition of a search. So the report also acknowledges that it's, you know, easy to de-anonymize and identify individuals. So when you hear about data that's anonymized, that's very easy to decode now. And that can be used to identify everyone who attended a protest or a rally based on their smartphone location or ad tracking records. And it also notes, quote, the government would never have been permitted to compel billions of people to carry location tracking devices on their person at all times, to log and track most of their social interactions, or to keep flawless records of all their reading habits. Yet smartphones, connected cars, web tracking technologies, the Internet of Things, and other innovations have had this effect without government participation. And lastly, for his part, Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, told Wired, quote, I've been warning for years that if using a credit card to buy an American's personal information voids their Fourth Amendment rights, then traditional checks and balances for government surveillance will crumble. And I don't want to flatten everybody here into the same pancake, but we've seen distrust in government emerge as a driver in our politics. We discussed some of this in the earlier segment. And whether it's Ron Wyden's concerns about buying information or John Ossoff's concerns about surveillance or MAGA Republicans concerned about the deep state and calls to abolish the FBI, there is enormous and growing distrust in institutions, and in particular, government and the government's use of surveillance technologies. And so I wonder, you know, how both of you are reading this particular phenomenon in politics, the growing trend. Earlier we talked about how Trump is framing his indictment as a political tactic, right, to try and steal the 2024 election. How do you think this kind of messaging is going to evolve and mutate, specifically the people who are already skeptical? And given that Democrats are also questioning the legitimacy of these programs and have very good reason to, especially in the wake of Dobbs, when we're talking about the vulnerability of period tracking app data falling into the hands of people who can prosecute women seeking abortions. This is just like an 800-pound gorilla, I think, in our politics. I'm sorry. I'm ranting a little bit. The ladies are smiling at me. I'll stop talking now, but
no, it's okay. I'm going to go live off the grid.
There's a lot here.
After that entire conversation, I was literally like, so anyway, I'm just going to leave here and throw all of my devices away and live in a cabin in the Maine woods, and you'll never see me again, right?
Yeah, that seems right.
Can I build a cottage on your
absolutely.
Property?
You absolutely can. And I won't be able to text you because I won't have any sort of devices.
Just send the dog with a note attached to the collar.
Around me, yes. So I'm going to take this angle, which is seeing this through the eyes of, I have a teenager who has known nothing but this world, right? And the assumptions that they make about their, not just their privacy, but just in the ways in which information comes to them. And the way that they have to sort of filter through this. So he knows that we track his phone, but he also has figured out ways, thanks to friends, to how to like hack certain things that I thought we had prevented him from doing, like getting on Snapchat or other things, which he's found ways around, right? So he sort of accepts both of those at the same time. He gets inundated with all sorts of information from his friends and their conspiracy theories, as well as whatever he's watching on YouTube, right? And trying to figure out which what is true and what is not, and how to make sense of all of that. Then I will tell you, I went and I spoke at a college and to a group of students who are in the media program, in specifically, right, undergraduates in that program. How do you guys get your news? Mostly TikTok. Great. Well, like, how do you know what's true, what's not true? What do you trust? Do you not trust? Oh, we just know. We have kind of a bullshit meter. And I was like, really? So tell me, he goes, one guy's like, well, why do you think that, you know, the New York Times is any better? Remember the New York Times and their great reporting on the Iraq War? Why do I trust them? And I said, okay, well, let me ask you this. So if you see something, you're like, some TikTok person put that up there. How do I know this is true? And then one of them goes, well, I Google it. And I said, okay, well, then something comes up as an answer.
Another TikTok.
And then it's, I said, so if the New York Times came up and said, that's actually correct or not correct, would you believe that? Yeah, sure. Well, why do you not read the New York Times? Like, I'm not, so I think we, this is where the conversation to me is so fascinating is, old people like me, people who were born in the 20th century and who still have a mindset of the 20th century, right? Like, I can't, yes, I know how to use a smartphone, barely know how to use other social media, et cetera. But we still are in this mindset of like, there's this box and that's where information is versus this generation that they've known nothing but and their way of thinking through it is so very different, because this idea of institutions and they should protect our information, or there are these filters that we should trust that is, will take this information and give us the truth about it. They don't, that's not a world they've ever known. So that's where this evolving, this generational shift to me is the most fascinating around some of these issues, because they are already skeptical. But they've also never had an experience of a filter that they believe is right? Like, this is right and true.
Yeah. Right.
Well, and I think Amy is taking us to the future, but I just wanted to take us to the past because the first, when I first came to DC, it was during the George W. Bush administration, and I worked at a place called Alliance for Justice on things like Guantanamo detainees and FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And it is just astounding to me, two huge differences between that time and this time. The first is that at that time, we thought the threat was outside the house, right? Yeah. We thought the bad things that were going to happen to us were coming from somewhere outside the U.S. So if we could keep a bubble around the U.S., and then the folks outside, we could be fine with the folks outside not having any rights, which is why we have Guantanamo still. But we didn't want it to apply to us. And I think that's radically shifted now. And the fact that, you know, the FBI is using this on, like, Black Lives Matter protests in January 6th, you're like, people think the threat is coming from inside the house. And I think in a lot of ways they're right at this point. And that makes that geographic bubble totally disappear, right? Totally. It's not, last time our conversation was, well, what if someone's in the United States talking to someone outside the United States? Can you monitor that conversation? And the answer was, well, yes, because we're afraid of 9/11 happening again. So we can pierce that bubble in that way. But if you're a person in the U.S. talking to another person in the U.S., that's private. And that's not That's not what we're afraid of anymore.
Or you get a warrant.
Which makes all sense, right?
If you say the problem is within the house, if you say, oh, well, we are much more worried now about white nationalism.
That's right.
We are worried about people who ostensibly are protesting, but really are trying to do more. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. You go to a judge and you say, this person we think is a threat, and blah, blah, blah. And we do they call it tapping your phone anymore? Is that even a thing? I don't know.
They call it metadata.
Right. Okay, thank you. So that's fine.
Yeah.
But this idea that, well, hold on, right? And again, thinking through the generation, how old is John Ossoff? But, right? Isn't he like 47?
Five?
No.
He's in the late 30s,
is he I don't think he's even in 40.
I don't think he's 40 yet. Yeah. He might be.
But if you think about, to your point, about 2001, right? Yeah. This is not somebody who has known of a world pre, of course, terrorists are coming to get us.
Right.
We have to have this warrantless search because there's no other way to, you know, we got to make sure that the threat doesn't come to onto our shores. But it is a very hard argument to make now, not just because the technology has changed, but because we know so much of, you know, the abuse that could happen.
Yeah. But I think the other thing that's different, to your point about the technology that's changed, is, you know, people for the past couple of decades, as this has been continuing to evolve, people have been okay with private companies having way more data than the government, right? And in part because it makes things really convenient.
Yeah.
You know, Ron and I were having a great conversation about being Instagrammed earlier, and then you're like, cool, that is a jumpsuit that I want to buy. One click, done. Thank you so much for my Apple Pay and it coming directly to my home.
Exactly.
And I'm in that category too. And so I think, you know, there were always the folks like Ron Wyden who were like, this is where this is going to go. The government's going to get this data. If anyone has it, the government's going to get it. And he's been on that since the 90s. He's the only person in Congress who's been on that since the 90s. But, you know, it's now we're seeing if the government is saying anything publicly available includes anything that I could potentially buy from anyone, that pierces that veil. That means anything that any private company has access to can go to the FBI.
Yeah.
And that is a totally different world.
It's a scary place.
So I think, I mean, if that's truly what we're going to say is public, like, that's everything.
Yeah.
They don't have to do their own.
You can buy everything
surveillance.
You want. Like all the Experian data dumps, the AT&T. There's been so many breaches of the most sensitive and intimate information on American citizens that, like, you can buy it anywhere.
Right. And a couple of years ago when we had one of the shooters that had his cell phone and the government got in a big fight with Apple about whether they would unlock the cell phone.
Right. Yep.
Well, if they could have just said, here's a check, we'll buy the data.
We don't need the hack.
That doesn't seem right to me. And it seems very scary because I am one of those people who kind of trusts private companies to, like, use my data in a way that's helpful to me and I'm not that concerned about it. But if they're selling that to the government, mm-hmm. I'm like, wait
yeah.
a minute.
Yeah.
I don't really like that, to your point about jobs, to a lot of these places that are, you know, in a Ron DeSantis administration. Like, how are they going to be using that power? I don't feel very comfortable with that. And I wonder if that is going to make a difference to this new generation that's grown up with, of course, they're going to know where I am. Like, why wouldn't they know where I am?
Yeah.
My parents have a tracker on me, essentially.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I want to just reprise Mike Madrid here for a minute. My friend Mike Madrid is a frequent Politicology guest, one of my ride or die in Ukraine when we went there, which is this idea that privacy, as we're talking about it, and specifically privacy as a check against government authority or abuse, has the potential to be seen as the new Second Amendment, whereas the Second Amendment originally, its original purpose was essentially to defend against abuse of the government, right? Mm-hmm. And that's useless now. If the government wants to come, like, you know, bulldoze your house with a tank, they're going to do it. The rifle's not going to stop them. However, maybe privacy, secured cryptographically, perhaps, could be a new way for people to protect themselves against intrusion from the government. What do you
And having a conversation about privacy that is approachable. So I think you hear the term privacy and we immediately get to, well, everybody knows everything about me because, I like Apple Pay and I really don't. I mean, I remember so specifically the first time I typed my credit card onto a website and I was like, this is so stupid. Why am I doing this? Like,
it's out there.
That's it. I'm going to totally get hacked. Yeah. All my money's going to be gone. But God, I really do like that shirt. Oh, it's so cute. Dink. Right? Like, it just overpowered my brain just screaming at me that this is so dangerous.
Yeah.
The first time I got into an Uber, right? Like, I'm going to be murdered. This is insane. Why am I getting into a stranger's car?
I remember that feeling.
Right? Yep. So we are, so we have to have that same conversation, which is to say, yes, you're so comfortable doing this. Mm-hmm. Now let's take it to where else your information is going. Mm-hmm. And why, what this means. When we say privacy, it's not just about that Apple has all your stuff or that. It's what is government doing once it gets it?
And
what are the rules? Right. And
what
are the rules to ensure that?
Yeah.
Because I hear, like, we're having a panel on privacy and literally my eyes are like glaze over. Right. Oh my God. And then we're section 702 and the
FISA.
Right. And you just go, this has nothing to do with me. Or what other people another reaction would be, I don't commit crimes, right? Mm-hmm. So it's good.
I got nothing to worry about. I got nothing to hide.
I got nothing to hide. No. And now you say, well, do you track your period? Do you track your, you know, whatever other things that you have, your heart rate monitor or whatever it is?
I'm wearing a strap now that measures, like, I don't know, a dozen different biomarkers and like signals about what my body is doing now. And that information is going into the cloud.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's all a little bit, right? So this is I think it's a fascinating conversation in the same way that the Social Network documentary was a really good way to help, especially again, younger folks understand what this is.
Yeah. John Ossoff is 36, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Younger than all of us. Okay. Now that we're up to speed on some of the biggest stories this week, let's talk about what we're watching. Under the radar, over the wherever it falls on the radar, Amy, what'd you bring for us?
I mean, unfortunately, I already used it. But I wish I had held on to it, which was this thing about watching these vulnerable House Republicans as we're going through this process, especially in the defense of Trump. But something else I'm writing about this week is a new analysis of Latino voters by Equis, which does a lot of great work. They are a progressive organization. I like working with them because, yes, they have a point of view, but their data is, they are not trying to sugarcoat or, you know, wrap it into some narrative. And it raised two really interesting points, I think, about 2024. The first is that these voters who showed up in 2020, but didn't show up in 2018 or 2020, are very open to persuasion by Republicans. Mm. They're very open to voting for Republicans. So this idea that, well, just because Democrats did well with Latinos in 2022 or as well as they did in 2020, that should not be seen as a sign that there's the possibility of more erosion could not happen. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that I found very interesting about these same voters is it also pushes back on the narrative that Republicans are doing better with Latinos because they're seen as the multicultural working class party, right? You've heard that a lot. The reason I think they see Republicans as good on the economy is that, right, they know Republicans have money and they talk about business and they talk about, so they say, yes, I think that when it comes to inflation, cost of living, I think Republicans do a better job than Democrats. Okay, well, who do you think looks out for you? Who do you think is the party that looks out for rich people? Oh, the Republicans, right? So they are holding both of those at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it is this idea that they're moving into saying, oh, I see Republicans as fighting for the working people. What they see is Republicans know how to make money. I don't know if it's exactly this, but something of the value. If we're in a tough economic time, the Republicans are going to find a way to focus on the economy, and that's good, and hopefully get me a job. But do I think that they're out there saying, we're with the little guy? Mm. We're going to make sure that the little guy's getting taken care of? Not so much. That's not there yet.
Yeah.
I think that's right. There's still so much trickle down, like, in there, right? Like, it'll be better for me because the whole thing will be better. And my perpetual frustration is we always ask this question about, for each party, do you think that they're more focused on the economy or more focused on social issues? Mm. I was having a conversation with someone yesterday who was like, we just need to make the case that the Republicans are the ones that are focused on social issues. And I'm like, people have said that to me for my entire career, and it doesn't work because every single time, no matter how many DeSantises are out there, people will say, yeah, I think Republicans are focused on the economy. And they'll say, I think Democrats are focused on social issues. And I'm like, my perennial example of this is when all the marriage bans were being put on the ballot. And then we had a poll in the field and said, who do you think is bringing up this issue? They were like, it's the Democrats. It's the gays. And I'm like, it's a ban.
Literally, it's Bush Cheney for
it. It's a ban. Why would I put that on the ballot, friend? But it doesn't work because that's our brand. We care about, you know, social issues.
And care about, right. And so, and sometimes it's if it's caring about you, what the Obama campaign learned how to turn that into actually an economic argument, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is the economy not doing great still? Yeah, that's right. But at least Obama's trying and he's working with you. And remember Mitt Romney, he's just a vicious capitalist who
47%.
Puts his dog on his car.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Half y'all are takers.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Well, here we are.
What'd you bring?
So I also used my earlier one about how Kevin McCarthy is going to have to shut down the government in September because now they're reneging on the debt ceiling appropriations deal. So I'll bring something else that I've been watching and I've been really scared about that happened this week, which is, do you remember the Hyde Amendment? The Hyde Amendment is the rider that we put on any federal bill anytime that has anything to do with healthcare that says no federal tax money can go to pay for abortions. Mm-hmm. And it's caused, you know, countless fights on the Hill over and over again. You know, but it remains to be the case that we have literally in the ACA, we made an exception that says, even though most 90% of private insurers cover abortion because it's cheaper to get an abortion than to have a baby, we actually make you pay a separate $1 to that insurance company for your abortion coverage so that the subsidy that you're getting from the government is not paying for an abortion. Like it's a thing, right? They're now turning it on gender affirming care. And it is so scary. So this week I got an email from one of the openly gay members on the Hill because I've been doing a lot of work around trans youth. And they were like, we're going to have this hearing. And there is a bill that is about funding children's hospitals for research for rare diseases and cancers and things like that. And they're putting a rider on it that says if anyone at this hospital does any kind of gender-affirming care for someone under the age of 18, they can't have any of this money. And it is—
The hospital can't.
The hospital can't for cancer, for research around rare children's diseases for anything. And it is terrifying to me because I think this is our next fight, is that we're going to – and there's a lot of federal money that goes into healthcare. And so there's a lot of places that they can put this and say, you know, anybody who's funded by Medicaid or Medicare, anybody who's funded by, you know, any of the research money that we give to hospitals, you know, anybody who's regulated by the federal government, they're going to find a way to make it impossible to provide gender-affirming care without banning gender-affirming care. And that is horrifying to me, and I think we need to get ahead of it and figure out how to stop it, because that is a world I don't want to live in.
Is it all forms of gender-affirming care, including talk therapy and stuff, or is it just medical
treatments? The way they articulated it in here was anything. They did not specifically talk about mental health, although I think you could probably use it for that as well. They specifically articulated anything that involved physical treatment, including hormone blockers, including obviously cross-gender hormones if you're blocking the hormones, and any kind of treatment that would involve a doctor. And we've seen this happening. You know, Florida just passed a bunch of laws that make it near impossible for trans adults to get care because there's, you know, because they said you can't actually get it from a physician assistant anymore. That's where 80% of trans adults were getting their care, because there's not a lot of access to a doctor. I mean, I get most of my care from a physician assistant. And so I see that going the way of the abortion stuff too, where it's like, oh, your hallway needs to be bigger. And they're just going to make it impossible for certainly trans youth, but also trans adults to get access to the medically necessary care that they need. And I just really want to raise the alarm to folks about this, because it was under the radar. And we, you know, sent out a bunch of guidance about it, and everyone was like, thank you, because no one's talking about this. So please talk about it. Think about it. Think about how we can get ahead of this, because we cannot live in a world where people are not able to access medically necessary care.
All right, gang, before we flip over to Politicology Plus, where we're going to discuss the Supreme Court's decision rejecting racially gerrymandered voting maps in Alabama that diluted Black voters' power, where can everybody find you, follow your work on the internet, Lene?
I'm at Lene Erickson on Twitter, although most of that content is about my sparkle shoes. You can find my work at thirdway.org.
You just testified before Congress in your sparkle shoes.
In my sparkle shoes. And the committee staff did aver that I was the first one who had done it. So, but it's amazing. It's important to actually go to thirdway.org, because that's where the work
lives. That's where the work is.
Although the shoes, really, they're important.
They're fun.
Yeah, they are fun.
All the places you can be found,
All
Amy.
The places. So cookpolitical.com is the number one place to go. I also do not have any Instagram or Snap or anything in that. I don't know how to use those. So I still use Twitter at Amy E. Walter. And we have a podcast now that you can get on Yield, whatever they're called now, platforms for podcasts. It's called The Off Years, and it's the Cook Political Report talking about all kinds of cool stuff about Terrific. Politics.
Did Wasserman do it with you?
He did. We did one. We haven't done one yet, but we have done one about, we got really in the weeds. The goal is this will transition as we get into the on years into conversations in the weeds.
Got it.
I want to know how you're going to get the podcast online when you're in Maine and have no access to
I know it. That's a problem. That's
we're going to go back to the A-Trax conversation we were having
gosh,
before.
Totally. Yeah. I'm totally into that.
Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening. If you haven't yet, we'd appreciate it if you could open up the Apple Podcasts app and give us a 5-star rating and review over there. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. If you have questions about anything we've talked about, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. And even when we can't respond, we do read everything you send us, whether it's an episode idea, a guest recommendation, or just a simple note about how the show has impacted you. And we love hearing from you. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.